called Contemporary Technology. And these the students that take this course are a particular kind of students. They're students who have done usually very well in engineering. Quite often they have experience, a lot of professional experience. They come from different parts of the world. But they're raising the kind of question that says, all right, I'm good in technology. I see this as a technological world. But what really is technology? And there must be something more. It's that kind of question. They're really, in a sense, questioning the very thing that they're good at, technology. So that's been the course. And the course has evolved over about a 10-year period. And that's very good for me because I have to go ahead and develop material during the year, and then I present it to these students, and sometimes the material just bombs out. And so I have to rewrite it. So over 10 years, you begin to understand the topic a little bit, and the students test you out. And I just want to tell you a little bit about what we have found out over these 10 years. We found out, first of all, we want to find out what technology is. That's a tough phrase because we're so used to technology. We decided it was not machines. You can't simply say technology is machines. We can't simply say, well, it's engineers. We can't really say it's organizations like the Corps of Engineers. Well, what is it? What we ended up, and I'm going to write this down, just for you to keep in mind, is technology is a, what we call a background of human expectations about how you ought to behave and how things ought to be done. So it's a background of expectations. And I will just give you a few key words to these expectations. One of them, of course, is be efficient. Be orderly. Be practical. Be precise. Be objective. Okay? Be useful. Okay? I won't put all these down. This is part of what we call the technological background of expectations. These are expectations that you and I have in a technological society, and the engineering education basically is a way of teaching people how to do this in a specialized area. Teaching them how to go ahead and solve problems. I better put that down. Solve problems in an objective, precise, and orderly, and practical, and efficient way. How to approach any problem in a practical, orderly, planned, a useful way, precise way, objective way. That's what we found out that technology is. Okay? That's what it's not. And then because of that, we come along and we build machines, and machines help us to be practical and orderly and so forth. We train engineers so that we can solve problems efficiently, practically, and orderly. And we have organizations so that we can be efficient and orderly and so forth and so on. And we develop techniques. That's the kind of knowledge we have in society, which allows us to go ahead and be orderly and all the rest of this. And one of the primary ways that we justify our behavior in this is it works. Amen. It works. So if you want to justify something, okay, you don't say it's true, it's good, but you say, look, it works. Okay? And that's the way in the technological society we justify something. And when we say it works, what it means, well, it's useful, it's practical, it's precise, it's orderly, it's efficient, and that's what it means when we say it works. You see? So that's what technology is. And so that's what I'm coming out of when in my sessions for the next couple times, is that experience of actually teaching and working with the engineers and making this discovery that really technology is a background of human expectations. Okay, that's my introduction. Okay? And now what I want to do is start the session, okay? I want to introduce that so you know where I'm coming from. This session is about time, okay? It's about time. Okay, what is time? Now, I want to set some rules down here when we talk. One of the hard things when we talk in a church group quite often is we give a lot of church answers that we normally would not give on the outside world, you know.
And what I'd like you to try to do is think of the world out there that you live and work within and live within the everyday world and try and keep your answers that way, okay? Because that's the way we, you know, we operate, except on some days. I mean, at least that's the way I do quite often. It may not be right, but that's what we do. So what is time? What is time? Anybody think about that? Anybody have some ideas? Okay, a relationship, any relationship?
Any relationship to another relationship.
A relationship to another relationship. Any relationship to another relationship?
Yeah.
Okay. Somebody else?
A theme whistle.
A theme whistle, okay. We're using symbols now. Yeah. A system of measurement. Okay, somebody else? Okay, an increase in entropy. Well, they actually, I think they say that the increase in entropy shows the direction of time. Isn't that time's arrow? Isn't that what they say? In our day-to-day lives, most of us don't use the second law of thermodynamics, however. But they get into some problems, though. The physicists get into some problems on that by trying to say, why does time have one direction? And they try to use the second law of thermodynamics, but the second law of thermodynamics gets them in a little bit of trouble when they say, well, how did it all start? And they kind of avoid that question. Anyhow, there's a whole lot of philosophical things we could get into on the science. But let's just go ahead. Somebody else? Yeah?
It's a gift we get most equally.
It's a gift that we get most equally. Okay? You know that? Yeah? Somebody else? Okay, what I would like to do is to, I don't have a good answer for you. Because here's some of the things that I have. Well, time, there's a future, right? Everybody agree? Future isn't here yet. Everybody agree? Everybody agree? Well, everything exists in time, okay? That's a word we say, great. The future isn't here yet, right? The past is gone, right? So it's not here either. How much is in between the future and the past? Is the now. How long is the now? How fast?
Fast.
How fast, fast? It's infinitesimally small, right? Isn't that what our perception of time? Well, how can anything be then? How can a note, how can a song be? You can't have a song at an instant. You can't even have a note at an instant because a note is a wave. And in fact, they talk about matter having properties, wave properties. How can it exist at an instant? You can't have a wave. A wave needs a duration of time. Well, how long is now going to be then? Well, short. How short? You see, we get into problems. We get into problems. And if you really want to go ahead and understand the problems we get into, you have to listen to children when they start asking you about time. Okay, because see, children know that we are crazy. I mean, they really know that, and Walt, they have tremendous insight, and Walt brings out a lot of this great in some of the stories. So I want you to think back in your childhood, or think how you've responded to children, and how you've, should I say, explained what time is, or think how you've learned what time is. Now when I said children know adults are crazy, let me give you an example. Okay? A kid comes up, okay, to an adult. I'm hungry, adult, but it's only 4:30. That makes sense? The kid tries. What's 4:30? That's when the big hand's on the 6 and the little hand's between the 4 and the 5. Does that make sense? What does the kid ask then? No, they don't. They've asked two whys already. And one thing kids learn is when you ask the third why, you get in trouble. Okay? Because there's something to do with adults, that three whys is a critical mass of whys that causes some sort of distortion in their stomach. Let me test you on that. Just get in touch. Why? 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 You feel on the third one, your stomach kind of tightening up? You feel that? Okay. Well, what happened to you? Like, don't ask your father or ask your mother or don't be bothering that. Can't you see I'm busy? Okay? So, and what are some of the questions that the kids still have? Well, if time goes on and on, how did it start? And if it started, what happened before it? Do we answer those questions? Does anybody have an answer to those questions? Not only do we not answer the questions, but we don't tell the kids usually that we really don't know. What do we tell them? It's 9 o'clock, you're supposed to be in bed. 9 o'clock, I'm supposed to be in bed. You're late. How come the clock's not early? Right? Get in bed. The kids learn very quickly. What is the clock, then? What really is the experience of the clock? Is it measuring something that they've had explained to them? It's something running their life. It's something that does what? Something that controls their life, right? In order to provide order in their life, in order to make the operation of the home more efficient. See this stuff back there? Okay? What the clock is, you see, is a device that we strap to our bodies that allow us to meet the expectations of our society. It's not something that measures this thing in nature that's out there. See, the clock is something that allows us to go on out and measure, or not to measure something in life, but allows us to be efficient, orderly, practical, precise, objective, useful, and solve problems, and we justify it because it works. But we get so used to this, we take these expectations for granted, so much so that we think that the clock is measuring something real in life, real because these have become so real to us, not because somebody justified them, not because somebody, you know, proved them, but because force of habit. We have accepted these expectations as force of habit. And the example I give to you is your experience with the clock and your experience that you've transmitted to your children on clock. You didn't explain what time was. I don't think so. Okay? I don't know what I'd explain. Okay? And you and I have used it as a disciplinary device to help us meet the expectations, the pervasive and persistent expectations of our society. And those pervasive and persistent expectations of our society have a name. The name is technology. Okay? So my purpose in studying the nature of time is, first purpose is to get us to understand how pervasively technology has influenced us. It's not something that someone else does. We are in it. Okay? Now this raises some interesting questions. Okay? Interesting questions. Let me see if I can phrase a few of those questions. We take these expectations for granted, right? We take them for granted. They impinge upon us. If I say, don't waste time, or you're wasting time, if I say that, you don't really feel like, well, I'm doing something like wasting wood. I'm doing something like wasting coal. When I say, don't waste time, you feel it as a demand placed upon you. Right? A demand placed upon you. And that's what it is. Time is basically a disciplinary device in our society. And we, if someone says don't waste time, we start feeling maybe uneasy because we may not be meeting these expectations. We may not be orderly enough. We may not be efficient enough. And we may not be productive enough. We may not be useful enough. And so we start getting busy. Okay? Because of this background of expectations. So you see, there's more to this question of time than something in nature. Why do we say, oh, time is, or we think that time has something to do with nature out there? Well, because we're expected to be objective. We're not going to look for things that we expect of each other. We would think of it as something out there as measured. Okay, I'm going to read a few quotes from Matthew Fox. He was the theologian 2 years ago that was the Village Theologian, the book that we had selected. And here's something, I'll read a few of the things that he has to say. One of the most practical and significant questions that anyone can ask about our spiritual lives is the following. What is your attitude, definition, or treatment toward time? To the extent that we fail to ask ourselves and our spiritual associates such a question, we remain subject to spiritual manipulation. Manipulation. There is a technological word. Okay. In this system, manipulation is good. We manipulate the world. We fabricate things. But in our spiritual world, there is something uneasy about the word manipulation. It tends to take on a negative tone. Let me see if I can find another quote from Matthew Fox. He talks about control time. I should have put control up there. That's another word. We should control things. And Matthew Fox talks about that being the dominant form of time that we have. Time means control, efficiency, productivity. That is, it's technological time. But he goes on to say some other things. God's time is play time. It is also mystical time. This kind of sacred time, which is mystical or suspended time, is especially forgotten in our American culture. So there is, you see, in our acceptance of the technological concept of time, our taken for granted acceptance of it, there is something of spiritual danger in that. This is what Matthew Fox is suggesting. And it's also what I'm suggesting. And interestingly enough, it's what my students came up with as we began to study the limitations of technology. They didn't use the church language because that wasn't the language of that community. But they got up as close to the religious language as one can possibly get without using it, as we began to study the limitations. Let's see what the limitations of this are. I said that this is a background of taken for granted expectations. Okay? What happens when you take your expectations for granted? What happens? I mean, we take this for granted. We don't think about it. We don't question it. Time is something, of course, time. What happens when we take our expectations for granted? Yeah.
You get along,
and you get along in this culture because these are the pervasive expectations of our culture, right? Everybody agree with that? And if you don't get along, you get in trouble. And we impose these expectations on others. We do this. I'll give some examples later. Somebody else. You judge other people by that. You ever get on the phone and you wait for about, 15 seconds and there's no response and you start getting angry at them? You don't even know who they are. Why? Because they should be more orderly, more precise, more efficient. They're wasting my time. And why is it bad for them to waste my time? Because I'm supposed to be efficient and orderly and precise and all the rest of that. And how can I do that while I'm standing here in this blank phone? Or you get behind someone at a traffic light and it turns green and they wait 10 seconds before moving. You feel that building up inside of you. Let me see if I can read a little story in here, if I can find it, that kind of illustrates how these background expectations take over that. Okay, here we go.
An important organizational meeting is to be held at which you are expected to present information. You have rehearsed your presentation so that it will be precise, objective, and orderly. There it is. Okay? On your way to your meeting, your car stalls at a traffic light and you can't get it going. Horns start blaring at you. After all, you are disturbing traffic and wasting the time of others. They're annoyed at you. You become infuriated at them, the auto mechanics and the manufacturers of the autos. Okay? At the same time, the pressure of the background expectations starts to close in on you. You won't be on time. You imagine all those people sitting at the meeting, doing nothing, wasting time because of your absence. After a period of waiting, the meeting will be reorganized to go on without you. You will have disturbed the planned order of the meeting. You will not have accomplished your part in the plan and the order. You try to fix the car, but your efforts only mess up your hair and your clothes. Your hands are greasy. You glance at your watch. You're already late. You can't leave your car in the middle of the road. Finally, you realize that you can't make the meeting. You can't even phone and tell them. You direct traffic around your stalled car, hoping for some assistance will arrive. The unfairness of the situation frustrates you. They have let you down, and now you'll have to pay. Well, in this story that I have, you are being judged by this, and you are judging those people out there, those manufacturers of automobiles and mechanics that you don't even know. And you're judging them on this basis. They weren't orderly, they weren't precise, and because of that, the car doesn't work. And because I'm going to be late, I won't work, and I'll be criticized. You see, and you just take this all for granted. Okay? Now, what I'm suggesting is that we need to, and what Matthew Fox is suggesting, is we need to not take these expectations for granted. It's not that they're bad or evil. It's just, I think, that they're demonic. Let me use a theological term. Demonic, Paul Tillich uses the word demonic. Engineers don't. You don't use that on the outside. It's not a technological word, but it's a great word. Demonic is always associated with the good. Okay? So, we can do a lot of good with technology. We can help people in hospitals. We can feed people. We can build homes and so forth and so on. So the demonic is always associated with the good. It's a vehicle to goodness. A means to goodness. But it becomes demonic when it becomes overextended and it becomes the substitute for goodness itself. Okay? It becomes overextended. And so then what is important is not to be efficient in order to produce something that's really good. What becomes important is to be efficient, period. Be productive. How many politicians have you heard get up and speak about how we must increase our productivity? The productivity of what? They don't say that. Increase our productivity. Increase our efficiency. They don't even say efficiency at what? See, that's the demonic. It becomes dominating you rather than being something that you can use as a gift. It becomes something that dominates you. Well, what happens when that happens? One of the things that happens when you start taking these expectations for granted is you stop asking the question, what is expected of me? And you stop asking it in a broad, full way. You begin taking for granted that what is expected of me is to be orderly, to be precise, to be efficient. Okay? You start taking that for granted and you stop wondering what is expected of me, and that is a religious wonder, a spiritual wonder. Because when you ask the question, what is expected of me, in the broad context, you don't take for granted your expectations. You're opening yourself up. You're setting aside the expectations of the society. And you're opening up to
for something other than the fabrications of our own minds and our own culture. That, you see, is the beginning, I'd say, of religion. And my engineering students, we reach that stage, we start saying, we have to ask the question, what is expected of us? And that's about as close as you can get to a religious question without throwing in all the church words. But it's a good way, I think, a good way. How do we ask the question, what is expected of us? First of all, it's not an intellectual question. Because the intellect, you see, is an arrangement of a kind of a set of practices of how we're supposed to ask the question, you see. It's based on the expectations. And if you come up with an intellectual one, of course you'll demand that it be precise, and demand that it be objective, and demand that your answer be all of these things right here. Okay? How do you ask the question, what is expected of me? It seems to me you have to set aside your expectations. You have to be vulnerable to something other than the manipulations of our own expectations. You have to be vulnerable. You have to set aside time. Do you get it? Set aside time. Now at Holden we have a number of books and a number of talks in there about solitude, about contemplation, and they talk about setting aside time. Now, what I'm saying is when we set aside time, we set aside our expectations that we have to be efficient, we have to be productive, we have to be useful, we have to be practical. We set aside those expectations so that we can be open to something other than our own expectations. It's not that our expectations are bad. They're bad when they dominate. Now we set aside our expectations when we truly listen to someone, right? You truly listen to someone. You can feel these expectations trying to crowd that out. You try to listen to something, you say, I'm wasting time. You start feeling that. When you truly listen to someone, you set aside your own expectations. When you contemplate and you meditate and you take some time for solitude, you set aside your own expectations. When you appreciate, you set aside your own expectations. And when you do that, you become vulnerable. Vulnerable to whatever might be beyond your expectations. And you can become hurt. You can, that's part of being vulnerable. Part of setting aside your own expectations. You, in a sense, deliberately sacrifice power. That's what you do when you set this aside, because there should be no doubt in your mind that these are the expectations of power. We have the power to destroy our whole globe because of technology. Because of this, we do. And so when you set aside time, you are setting aside power, you are becoming vulnerable, you are caring, you are essentially setting this aside. Okay? Setting this aside. To me, that explains a few things in the Bible that I never understood before. Okay? Let me give you one. You remember when Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? Remember that? Do you remember Jesus' answer? Remember his name? What was his answer? Hey, you've given the answer. Right? And I remember thinking, boy, he really blew it. Here he had a chance, here's the leader there saying, what is truth? And he could have really clarified things, could have really given a good explanation. Okay. What did he do instead? He stood there vulnerable and committed. And I think that's where we receive, really, at the bottom line, where we receive truth. We receive what truth is. truth, love, in vulnerability. And that was the only answer he could give. He was committed and vulnerable. Any explanation that he would have given would have been something to meet the expectations of his culture. The only thing he could do is stand there, vulnerable, because in the end, that's where the truth comes through to us, in our vulnerability. Anything beyond our vulnerability is a product of our own manipulations. And in our world, it's a product of technology. Okay, I want to clarify, I don't believe that technology is bad. I said it was, it becomes demonic. If we don't take our technological expectations for granted, how should we approach technology? I say as a gift, as a gift. And a gift is something that you never take for granted, right? A gift is never something that is there to trap you, to wrap you up. A gift is not something that's supposed to dominate your whole lives. A gift is something that can be appreciated and set aside also. That's what we have to learn. But it's not going to be easy, because this pervades so much of what we do. And in the next series of talks, I'm going to try to get that across, of how this background expectations pervades so much of what we do. Okay, now what I'd like to do now is end my, I said I'd allow more discussion, but I started rambling too much. Some ideas you have to throw out here. This is kind of the first in a series, so I really depend upon your inputs here.
Question is, is what I see in people that are older, have they learned some of this by experience? Because I see that they don't think of time, technology like I do, or like people who are very young.
Right.
Is it something we do learn by experience as a rule, or?
I think it's something we can learn as experience. And I think that the older people, in a sense, have a special gift. We don't see it as a gift. But physically, they can't be as efficient and productive as they used to be. And so they, in a sense, are forced to, one, either feel like a failure, because they can't be young again and efficient, productive, and all this new knowledge that comes out, or they're forced to contemplate. And I don't mean intellectually. And I think you'll find an awful lot of the older people who've come to realize that all this running around, there's something more. The problem, I think, is getting people to listen to them and listen to their stories, and I think Walt pointed that out. I had a little footnote in here on this that I wrote. I found it written in here. I write little footnotes as I was preparing for this class, and I said one of the questions we have to ask, do the children gather around the old people to listen to the stories of the old? And I said that was a question that came to my mind, same one I think you had. Well, if we're faced with this technological dominance, what would be some of the signs? And one of the signs might be that the children don't gather around the old to listen to their stories. Because, the old aren't efficient, productive, orderly. I mean, you go someplace else.
In our society, also the old are often not with us.
That's right. So I think that would be one of the signs of the dominance of the technological expectations. Another one would be that we treat stories as mere entertainment. We don't really treat stories, involvement in other people's experiences, as being a grounding of truth. Okay? Walt, and I'll get back to Cammy, and then I'll go up there.
Step farther, my parish is inner city, which is another culture altogether, and I remember how much I judged the entire culture. We were supposed to start church at 11. And I think 20 people at 11, they come moseying in all the way up to 11:15, 11:20.
Right.
And what I've seen since then is that the outside of the city, the suburbs and so forth, ringing around, for example, the black and the poor, dismiss them absolutely as lazy people.
That's right.
Who shop when in fact they are living, and they're living whole, but they're living in a different way.
That's right.
And there is no laziness there at all. In fact, there's a great deal of energy expended.
Yes.
But we cut off then the blacks. We consider them to be
exactly. I had the same experience. I worked with American Indian. And when someone said, well, the celebration begins at 4 o'clock Indian time, how many people have experienced Indian time? Okay. If you go there at 4 o'clock, what happens? No one's there, probably. Okay. No, it's not, it's because you see, precision, order, and efficiency aren't particularly important in that society. What is important is nurturing relationships. And of course, you don't do those objectively. You do them by becoming involved. You don't do them as a detached observer. I think we also find that the women's movement, basically, is not, you know, a lot of their writers are not as dominated by this as men. I mean, men are more dominated by the technological background, at least I think. Tammy.
Well, one thing that occurred to me is that in reordering my own life, a change in perception of values, and that it was only through trauma and a real kind of value clarification that I've made different choices the last 6 years than I did before that. And a part of that was giving up the need to meet all these expectations for myself and saying it's more important to sit down and read a story than to have the house clean. Or it's more important to be with friends or to feel comfortable waiting for them even though they're going to be late than to always be watching the clock. And when I went through my divorce, one of the first things I did was put my watch in the drawer. And somehow to me that was sort of a symbol of reordering my life and not depending on the clock.
Yeah.
And now I wear a watch again, but I certainly don't have the same sense of it telling me what to do.
Right. Okay. Then when you do that, the watch could be a gift rather than, once you are able to set it aside, the bell, for example, it can be. The bell is hooked up to a clock in the kitchen, and that allows us to all gather for those meals. It helps us to, it facilitates that. So it's a facilitator of something more important, the coming together and sharing as a community. Okay? Yes. Oh, I'll come back up there.
We've been here for about 5 days, and it seems like we've been here for a very long time, and you forget about what day it is.
That's right.
Now, how do you take that and take it back with you to where you live? Because our society has so many expectations. My brother-in-law's family is very easygoing. They don't care if they're on time or not. My husband is more, let's go now. We should be there at this time. Where's the line in between where you should be at, and how do you...
I really don't have a good answer because we are wrapped up in a technological world. We are wrapped up in it not just in terms of time, but in terms of language. Let me give you one example in terms of language. The word communication. We say we've had in our culture a tremendous advance in communications. What does it mean that we can transfer tremendous amounts of information? And what is information? It's measured in bits. Nice, precise. And we say we have an advance in communications when the average person spends, 6 hours sitting in front of a box watching characters that don't even exist, and we call it an advance in communication. What's happened is the word communication has been taken over by these expectations, and it's now separated from the word communion and community. You see, so even our language has changed. Even our language. I would say what we need to do is we do need to set aside time. And I don't mean just schedule it. I mean actually set aside time, set aside this to nurture, you know, the things, to be vulnerable to something other than this. We need to do that. It's not easy. I don't have any good answers for you. It's something that we need to do. Up here, someone had their hand, then I'll come back down. Up there, anybody? Okay, back down here.
Is part of the trouble that we get into in terms of both technology and time is they're so wrapped up in our economic system.
That's right. They're wrapped up everywhere we go. We educate people, their jobs are that way, and I'm not saying technology is bad, because it does a lot of good things. It's the dominance of technology. So I guess we need to recognize that these expectations are there, and like I say, set aside time. Open for, be vulnerable in solitude, to try to practice the art of listening to stories. Well, maybe some of those are the things. Let's see, someone else, yes.
The phrase comes to my mind, living in the world but not of it.
Yes, like, that's the second time, that's a beautiful phrase.
The world is this way, and we need to function in it, but I very much appreciated your phrase, using technology as a gift.
That's right.
That we can use it, but we don't have to be in the technological world functioning simply
right.
as part of it. We have also the freedom to step outside it.
We don't take it for granted, because it's really expectations, and if we take them for granted, that they impose on us all the time, which means we're dominated by this. Yes?
A couple things occurred to me while you were talking. One is to handle the question with youngsters. Frequently, we'll ask your father, right?
Yeah.
So he comes home to talk with the answer. And secondly, this can be expanded to distance. Do you ever notice when you leave the house, and you no sooner get around the corner, and the youngsters ask, are we there yet?
Yeah. My kids do. I've learned a lot of this from my kids. My one boy has this joke, are we there yet? And the obvious answer is no. Obviously, no matter where we are, we're here. And we have these little games, because actually I learned about time from my kids, the questions they ask. I think if our kids ask us what time is about, maybe we ought to say, well, I really don't know. I think it's, you know, be honest with them. What do you think it's about? You probably learn a lot from them. Yeah. Yes?
Well, I'm really resisting a lot of this, because I'm a single parent, I work full time, and I volunteer 15 to 20 hours a week, and my time is extremely important to me. And when I try to be on time for everything I do, and when someone is not on time with me, I look at it as a lack of respect. And like for a lot of these meetings we're having, it's really great when everybody's here on time, because everybody can participate.
Okay. You know? I accept that. I really accept that. I don't want us to think of time and meeting time schedules as bad. The trick is to not be dominated by those expectations to the point where we think that's the way the real world really is. Obviously, if you agree to meet with someone and there are a lot of things happening, it's a good part of the human relationship to show up together so that you can do it. If you've agreed on that, there's a certain trust commitment that's there. The clock then can be a gift to help facilitate that. But we have to remember, you know, that the really important thing is the facilitation of that relationship, not responding to the clock. The clock then becomes a gift. Do you agree with that?
Yeah,
okay, I agree. Now, I got a little take back there on Christmas time. And where I say, well, according to technology, Christmas occurs on December 25th. Okay? According to the black community or the American Indian, Christmas time occurs when all of those relationships that make up the celebration of Christmas come together. Then it's Christmas time. You see? And if those relationships don't all come together, then Christmas time isn't. December 25th is, but Christmas time isn't. And how many times do we miss Christmas time because we're so worn out for being efficient and orderly and all the rest of these things, and we miss Christmas time because we think Christmas time is December 25th. Now, I don't say let's throw out the calendar, because by agreeing on December 25th, that may allow us to bring together our activities and our relationships so together we can celebrate Christmas time, which is, I think, kind of your notion. But if we start thinking Christmas is on December 25th, and therefore I must be efficient, orderly, and planned, and all the rest of that, we can be so dominated by this that Christmas time never comes, only December 25th. Okay, so
perhaps exhaustion from preparing.
Oh yes, and the exhaustion is a message. I think it's a message. It's a message, you know, we're physically exhausted. It's a message that you've carried this too far, and you missed the point. All of this should be in order for something else. But when we take this for granted and it becomes the something else, then it becomes the mind. Yes?
Is balance a good word to indicate?
Balance is one word, I would say. Care is another, vulnerability is another, setting aside. We need to use these words so that we can deal with the problem a little bit better. Yes? Someone else?
Some of us, she was mentioned that she feels like it's a lack of respect when people don't show up on time. Some of us have never learned to judge our time well. I know myself, if I'm supposed to be at work approximately a certain time, I think, oh, I think it gets me, I need the dinner started. I've tried too many things planned for a time. So it isn't lack of respect, it's just lack of good judgment on my part. So you suffer for it. Mm. But I haven't learned. I overschedule myself. I do it continually.
And part of that may be, I was a single parent too, so I can appreciate what you're going through. Part of it may be is we're trying to be too productive. We're so guilty when we're not busy. And we're not being efficient and productive and orderly, that we can't set aside any time without feeling guilty to this community. So I guess as a start, maybe we ought to use the clock as a gift, as a start. We ought to say, all right, look, one of the things I'm having a problem setting aside time, so I'm going to use the clock, and I'm going to, roughly around 4 o'clock, I'm going to forget about time until I hear the bell or something. And maybe that's a start. I don't know. I think we all have to discover this, because there is more precise and objective way we can do it, you see. But we need at least occasionally to pause from the dominance of this to remind ourselves that there's more, and to be vulnerable to some expectations other than the ones we take for granted. Yes?
It seems to me that the Sabbath is such a time.
Yes!
The biblical notion of Sabbath, kind of a time in the middle of time that's special and around which the rest of the week takes its order and finds its importance and so forth. One of the things we discovered in our parish this spring is that we were feeling the compacture of time on Sunday morning. Because we had more people coming to an early service, the service was extended a little longer because of the Eucharist and more people hanging around the table, you know, and celebrating and so forth. And Sunday school opening was delayed. And the stomach juices were beginning to, you know, freely form and a little stress. And then that class had to get out at a certain time so that we could begin the second service and the organ prelude and people walking in late. And we were kind of thinking, well, there are a lot of very good reasons that this problem is occurring, that we're kind of stepping on each other. But it's kind of a tragedy if the Sabbath is not modeling what this kingdom is to be about, at least in the use of time. What we are going to attempt, and you know, the clergy may get fired, we may find that it doesn't work, but we're just extending the morning a little bit, starting the early service a little earlier, and the late service a little later, and trying to celebrate and to expand the time so that there's a spaciousness in what we do on that one morning of the week.
One of the things at Holden where I think we set aside time in a sense, in the coffee breaks up there underneath the, you know, underneath the bell, where you go up there, there is no plan. There is, and I don't know how many of you have just learned as much there as you have in any session that you've been to. I mean, you learn so much there that you just don't know that there's that many stories that people could share. And part of it is, and no one plans it. So I'm not saying we should do that all the time, because this is a gift. I mean, there's a lot that we can do. We can schedule our church services so everybody shows up. But we try not to be dominated by it. And we try to recognize that domination of it excludes a lot that's important. Yeah.
We saw a part of that problem, and that's the parking lot determines when we have worship.
Oh, really?
If it's
it's full, they don't come? Or?
Well, so that cars can get in and out. You certainly don't want to have anything overlap. And
I find that I've
cars are of primary importance. And
I find quite often the part I seem to get the most out of the church is the coffee hour. And, you know, I almost feel guilty saying that, but no, I don't.
That's because you always sit in the back row.
Yeah.
That's a nice preach.
We had a similar situation, and I was the Sunday school coordinator, so I really were begging for more time at Sunday school. But how do you, you know, talking about time and having that more spacious time, how do you train your congregation to?
Well, finally, that's the point. Well, nobody liked
the new schedule, so
we switched
again, and
we're
back to the old
one. I really don't know. I don't have an answer. I would say, you know, my role as a teacher is, if we can at least destroy some of the myths about time, that it's really measuring something, and we can accept responsibility for the fact that these are our expectations. They're not something out there that nature is imposing on us. Then we might have, might be able to discover a little bit more. But I don't have a good answer, because we live in this technological world where this dominates considerably. I do think maybe what congregations have to do is they have to set aside times, maybe retreats where people get out and they're away. I find, you know, when you go to some retreat and you eat a meal together where you're, what you're doing, and you prepare it together so that the meal comes together not because it's 6 o'clock, but it comes together because you're starting to smell the food and you start, in a sense, that acts out a different kind of time. And maybe we need to do those things. And you find a lot of people get an awful lot out of those special times we set aside.
The technological question seems to be a how question. And the question that we need to ask on the Sabbath is, you know, why?
That's right.
And for what reason and what? Those kinds of questions. I guess, you know, an answer to this, all we could do, we wrote some questions and answers about the new worship schedule. It's going to happen, rally day, whatever, the second Sunday in September. I might go back to the Lion's Den. The questions and answers, finally, the last question was, is this schedule cast in bronze? And finally, we had to say, we are dependent upon, or we are organizing around the gospel, which will give shape, hopefully, to our morning together. Which means it may not be, but at least that's the question we have to ask, is why? What?
I think we should have a liturgy that celebrates mistakes. I mean, really, where it would be the kind of thing where we would actually celebrate that somebody had the courage to try something and then finally admit that it was wrong. Okay, I mean, how many times do we not do something because we're afraid we might be wrong? And if we could have kind of a liturgy, an actual a celebration, and put in the liturgy some absurdities and some things like that, we would actually celebrate, you know, some of the heroes in the Bible who botched up things, and we really could identify, because we are a community of bunglers, and that's why we have grace, okay? And if we could actually celebrate that, maybe that would help. Maybe you know, we ought to make the service itself reflect that
moment.
And start 15 minutes late. And start right. And I do those things.
Not be able to
sing
the hymns.
Yeah, we got to have a little easier hymns to sing than some of the Lutheran ones, though.
It always amazes me that if you talk about changing the service by 15 minutes, the summer or the schedule, it's just like you.
Yeah. You're going to lose all your memories.
Or maybe we should have one service where we have the coffee break starts at 10 o'clock and the service sort of happens after that. We'll try it. In a big congregation, that would be awfully hard. I agree with that. But maybe if we could try those things, and then when it didn't work, we would say, all right, it's time for the liturgy of bungles and mistakes. And then we could go out and celebrate the fact that we tried something and it didn't work, and then we're a community that celebrates grace, and then we could smile at it and we could have some joy out of it. So I nominate for the people who are in the church as an idea to have a worship service and liturgy for mistakes and bungles.
Well, I relate more to the person that would not walk by somebody else and say hi and then leave. In some cultures, that's considered a real slap in the face to say hi and then pass on. It's like, where was the how are you? And when can I tell you how I'm doing today? And when can I find out how you're doing today?
Yeah.
And how your family is doing today? I believe that each of us are temples of God, and that's a lot of my Christian maturity is from the people that God has placed around me. And it also helps to live within a framework. I will say the person that is more expects things to happen on time probably is in a situation where they are more in control of their time. Whereas someone that lives in a situation where what they do and plan for has a lot of other people interacting that are going to be changing it all the time, you're looking for God in those changes. I think I've led worship for many, many years, and the worship that I have so organized and so planned for a group of, first of all, it's preschoolers, and then first to sixth grade, first to eighth grade, the ones that I have so planned are not open. So what's happening to me out there in the faces of the children and people that are around me, and the ones that I walk in there and pray for and have the feeling for the theme for the day, which I take from the actual worship service, are the ones that I am looking in the eyes and in the sounds from the children and the people around me, and I'm more open to having that worship service flow in that direction. And those are the ones that when we're done, I know have been a more worshipful experience. And when I thought, today we are going to emphasize this, I'm going to say it three times, and they are going to get it, and I may repeat it next Sunday so that they get it, and they never get that, because it was not what they were open to hear. And I guess that...
what gets me is sometimes, you know, they get something that's entirely different, that's better than you wanted to give.
I'm so really happy with that. It's not that he is in control, the Holy Spirit is there working.
Yeah, right.
And, yeah, true. Right. And not to be disappointed, because what I planned didn't happen the way I planned it, because it's the Holy Spirit there working. And that's where the joy is. And that,
that's good. We do have one, I want to point, we have your comments and Walt's comments there. Maybe one of the things we need to do is learn a little bit more from, say, the black church, because if this is a problem that we are having and we recognize that and we're so dominated by this, we in a sense have been blessed by people who have been persecuted in our sense, kept out of the mainstream, and because of that they're not as dominated by it, and we might be able to listen to them. And it's interesting, the little bit of black theology I've read, they don't have, I guess, the liberal conservatives the way we do. You know, the whole question of Genesis isn't, whether it's really scientific or not, is not a particularly important question to them. And they tell stories much more. Is that generally at all? Okay, the storytelling is so much more. So it seems to me that we have a very strong need to learn much from these communities that have not been dominated by technology, not only within America, but outside of America, the African church, which is a thriving Christian community. There's a lot that we can receive from them.
In the Old Testament, the Jews looked up fine. The Greeks came along and started organizing.
They had a Kairos time, didn't they? Walt, you correct me on this. Was a Kairos time was the time when things happened.
Fullness of time. Yeah.
That's when it happened. It seems to me ethically that had a beautiful notion, because no one knew when the Kairos time was coming, but it was really terrible to miss it. So, what it meant was everybody had to act and behave as though the Kairos time was here. And of course, if the Kairos time was here, all your efforts were futile. It meant nothing happened because the Kairos time wasn't there. But if you just happened to be acting when the Kairos time was there and everything changed and everything worked, you weren't any better than the other person who was the failure, because of course you didn't bring about the Kairos time. It wasn't your... Anyhow, there's some interesting things we could learn. Okay, I will go ahead and end the session here. Well, we can continue talking. I guess what I'd like to end it is, I think all of us are giving each other permission to set aside some time. And that means
to enter relationships, at least occasionally, that are not dominated by practicality, efficiency, usefulness, precision, and all the rest of that. And that we all agree to affirm each other to do some of that, not saying that this is bad. Okay, does everybody agree with that? We all agree that we're gonna affirm that. So if we need permission to do it, because this is pushing on us, we just remember that we were in Holden Village and there was a large community of people there and they all gave us permission to do that. Okay? Okay, thank you very much.